King Jesus, let heaven and Jacob swear. Jesus, let heaven and Jacob swear. Jesus, let heaven and Jacob swear. And he told her everything she'd done. He said, woman, I have living water. He said, woman, I have living water. He said, woman, I have living water. If you drink, you'll never thirst again. He said, woman, tell me where's thy husband. He said, woman, tell me where's thy husband. He said, woman, tell me where's thy husband. And she answered, Lord, I have none. He said, woman, thou hast had five husbands. He said, woman, thou hast had five husbands. He said, woman, thou hast had five husbands. And the one that you have now is not your own. She went running down to that city. She went running down to that city. She went running down to that city. She said, come see the man who knows the thing. Jesus met the woman at Jacob's well. Jesus met the woman at Jacob's well. Jesus met the woman at Jacob's well. And he told her everything she'd done. Jesus met the woman at Jacob's well. Jesus met the woman at Jacob's well. Jesus met the woman at Jacob's well. And he told her everything she'd done.
Welcome to another Bible lesson brought to you by the Hamilton Church of Christ. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13, there hath no temptation taken you but such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape that you may be able to bear it. Here we learn that Christians have a way to escape from temptation. Any temptation we have, it's a temptation that other people have had before us. It's common to man, and God will make a way to escape. So if we just look for that way that God has made for us to escape, then we can not have to go through the terrible sin that goes with temptation. We invite you to join us today in our Bible study.
As I travel through life with its trouble and strife, how the glory of God to give. On the waste and my toil will be o'er, and the rest on that shore where the night has been turned into day. Up in the beautiful paradise valley by the side of the river of life. Up in the valley, the wonderful valley, we'll be free from all pain and all pain and all strife. Shade of the evergreen tree. How long by the side of the river of river wine. And up in the valley, the wonderful valley, we'll be free from a band of strife. And there we shall live in the Lord's tenant garden, meet the shade of the evergreen tree. How long would a paradise, paradise valley, where the beauty of heaven, of heaven has seen.
We're now moving into the 46th chapter of Genesis. And in this 46th chapter, the story now includes not only Joseph and his 11 brothers, but also Jacob is involved, or Israel. As Jacob prepared to go to Egypt, with their sons and their wives and their children all going, Jacob is bound to have had some conflicting feelings about this. He was eager to see Joseph again, and he knew that the famine condition in Canaan required some type of positive action, so that he and his great family would be able to escape impoverishment, or maybe even probably death by starvation. God seemed clearly to be leading him to migrate to Egypt through the providential circumstances that happened to Joseph and his elevation to great power in Egypt. But at the same time, he knew that Canaan was the land God had promised Abraham and Isaac, and this had been confirmed to him in no uncertain terms. They had lived for many years in Canaan, and now he was uncomfortable at the thought of leaving it. He was born in Canaan. Until now, each time he had made an important move, God had spoken to him directly. When he left his parents to go to Haran, God had appeared to him at Bethel, Genesis 28:13-15. When he had been with Laban long enough, God instructed him to return to Canaan, Genesis 31:3. And even when he left Shechem, God had appeared to him, Genesis 35:1-9-11. Naturally, therefore, he was reluctant to make such a drastic move as this without getting some kind of confirmation directly from God himself that he should do this. After all, God would have been able to break the famine and supply their needs right there in Canaan if he wanted to, if it was his will to do this. And so Jacob really would have felt better for God to have told him what God wanted him to do. He knew that God had been able to provide miraculous things before, and he could do it again if he wanted. But now everything looked like it was the thing to do to move everybody into Egypt. So beginning chapter 46, verse 1, and Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac. Israel did start out on the journey regardless of the doubts he might have had. He took all of his flocks and possessions along with his family and servants. All the circumstances showed that this is what he should do. And so he went out trusting the Lord somehow to let him know if this were not the right thing to do. Anytime a believer in the true God should see that there is a decision to be made and he doesn't seem to have any absolute message from God as to which way to go, then he should proceed according to his best judgment, at the same time continue in prayer for guidance, at the same time continue to look at the scripture to see what the scripture had to say, and then he can have confidence that the Lord will either bless him in the decision he's made, or else he will overrule that decision and direct him in another way. But remember, prayer is the basis of this. We must keep communication up with God, continually asking God to show us, to guide us, to give us some indication of what the best course of action is. And so on his way out of Canaan, Israel had in mind to stop by the old altar at Beersheba, where he'd lived with his father Isaac, according to Genesis 28:10. Beersheba, of course, was near the very southern boundary of the land. And so when he got to this point, this is just before leaving the land of Canaan. And there at Beersheba, he offered sacrifices, thinking especially of Isaac and God's promises to his father. Verse 2 says, and God spake unto Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob, and he said, here am I. So that night, once again, God did appear to him in a vision for the eighth and last time, so far as this record goes. We have those appearances in Genesis 28:13, 31:3, 31:11, 32:1, 32:30, 35:1, 35:9, and now our verse at this passage, 46:2. It's interesting to see that the narrative says that God spoke unto Israel, but that he called him Jacob. In the rest of the book of Genesis, it seems that the two names are used indiscriminately and interchangeably. This is, for example, in Genesis 46:8, 46:27, 47:27, 47:28, 49:1, 2, 28:33. Verse 3 says, And he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. So at Beersheba, God set Jacob's mind at ease about going down to Egypt. God identified himself as indeed the God of his father Isaac. He also assured Jacob that he, El, the strong creator and sovereign of all men, would protect him and bless him in Egypt, even as he had in Canaan. Verse 4 says, I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again. And Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. So furthermore, in this promise that God made to Jacob, he assured him that he would bring him back up out of Egypt when the time came to do so. The promise, as it applied to Jacob personally, was only fulfilled after his death. Genesis 49:29 and chapter 50, verses 4-8. But it found its more complete fulfillment in the lives of his descendants in the days of Moses and Joshua. That's when they truly were brought out of the land of Egypt as a nation and then on the way to go to the promised land. God's purpose in leading Jacob and all of his family into Egypt was that he might there make of Jacob a great nation. Although the foundation of the nation had been established in the 12 sons of Israel, especially now that they had become unified in God's will and unified among themselves, their own descendants would need the discipline of living for a period in Egypt before they were really ready to assume their role in God's plan of things as a nation. Now we in our finite wisdom can't understand why they would need this 400 years of captivity in Egypt, when God well knew that there was a reason for it and a good purpose for it, and this was God's plan to bring it about like that. Egypt was, if anything, even more polytheistic and more idolatrous in its religion than Canaan. Yet there was not the great danger of them being absorbed into the Egyptian culture that they continually had confronted them in Canaan. The Egyptians felt themselves as racially superior, and they were very reluctant to mix or intermarry with foreigners, especially shepherds, according to Genesis 43:32 and 46:34. This was a fact which had been clearly confirmed by students of the Egyptian history. Also, these people were culturally and intellectually the most advanced nation in the world at the time, so there was much of future value the children of Israel could learn while in Egypt. They eventually were going to be a nation to themselves, and they were eventually going to have to fend for themselves in the world. But at this time, they quite evidently were not ready to do that. So this experience in Egypt will be a training period for them, a 400-year training period. Thus, though they could profit much, both financially and culturally, by associating with the Egyptians, they would be forced to dwell apart by themselves, developing their own peculiar culture, and in particular, learning to center their lives around the God of heaven and earth rather than the gods of the nations. So they probably learned many of the things that they have as peculiar to them as a nation, even today, with the roots beginning while they're in captivity in Egypt. All of this would forge them into a distinct and unique people, ready to receive and to carry out the laws of God and the great plan of God. Then in this statement that God made to Jacob, last of all, God assured him that he would see Joseph again. Furthermore, when Jacob's time to die would come, it would be his beloved son, Joseph himself, who would perform the sacred duty of laying his hand upon thine eyes, that is, of closing his eyes in death, for his burial. Verses 5-7, And Jacob rose up from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried Jacob their father, and their little ones, and their wives, in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And they took their cattle, and their goods, which they had gotten in the land of Canaan, and came into Egypt, Jacob and all his seed with him, his sons and his sons' sons with him, his daughters and his sons' daughters, and all his seed brought forth he with him into Egypt. So now that God had spoken to him, Jacob was no longer hesitant, but he immediately migrated to Egypt, taking all his cattle and other possessions, as well as his sons and granddaughters. He evidently also had daughters, according to verse 7, and granddaughters, even though Dinah is the only daughter whose name or birth is specifically mentioned in Genesis 30:31, and Sarah, S-E-R-A-H, the daughter of Asher, the only granddaughter, verse 17. The women and children were carried in the wagons, as was Jacob himself. The younger men apparently rode on the asses. In verses 8 through 25, we have a listing of Jacob's children and grandchildren who came with him out of Canaan. Since these verses are primarily the names of Jacob's descendants who went into Egypt with him, we're not going to read those verses. In verse 26, all the souls that came with Jacob into Egypt, which came out of his loins, besides Jacob's sons' wives, all the souls were 66. And the sons of Joseph, which were born in Egypt, were 2 souls. All the souls of the house of Jacob, which came into Egypt, were 70. So this says that there were 66 people that came with Jacob. And then, of course, Joseph and his 3 sons and Jacob himself would make a total of the 70. These 4 families as listed added to the 70 names. This number does not include any of the wives of Jacob's sons and granddaughters, nor the husbands of his daughters and granddaughters, but only those who were of his own seed. Of these, however, only 66 actually came with Jacob into Egypt, since Joseph, Manasseh, and Ephraim were already there when he came. Now this number 70 seems to be associated in a very special way with the nation of Israel, ever since the time when these 70 apparently became the official founders of the nation and moved into Egypt. For example, in Genesis 10, where we have the great division of the nations by tongues, they have the great dispersion of the nation at the Tower of Babel, these original nations that are mentioned there were 70 in number. And we learn in Deuteronomy 32 that this original number of 70 really was according to the number that God had made for this nation of Israel. Deuteronomy 32:8, where they are now in the wilderness shortly before they get into the land of Canaan, he says, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. So this number of originally 70 nations was set according to the number that would be God's people here as they became a nation, as they originally came into this land of Egypt. And we'd like to note also that there were 70 elders, according to Numbers 11:16, 70 years of captivity, 2 Chronicles 36:21, 70 weeks determined on the people of Israel to finish the transgression, Daniel 9:24, 70 translators of the Septuagint, translation of the Old Testament into Greek, 70 members of the Sanhedrin in the days of Christ, and 70 witnesses to Israel sent by Christ, Luke 10, verse 1. Even though the 10 sons of Benjamin may not actually have been born in Canaan, they are listed in order to make this role of founders parallel and complete, since all of Jacob's grandsons were to be reckoned among these founders. They were in the loins of Benjamin, at least, and so in that sense actually did go down into Egypt with Jacob. As a matter of fact, it's possible that they all could have been born while Benjamin was still in Canaan. Though Benjamin was not more than 25 at the time, at the most, it's conceivable that he could have married while in his teens, and then his wife or wives could have borne him 10 sons, including multiple births, within this relatively brief time. In view of their father's example, as well as that of Uncle Esau, some of Jacob's sons may well have had more than one wife. Simeon certainly did. The 70 original Israelites, summing up, included Jacob and his 12 sons, 51 grandsons, 2 great-grandsons, 1 daughter Dinah, 1 granddaughter Sarah, and 1 other unnamed daughter of Leah, and 1 unnamed granddaughter of Leah. Verse 7 indicates that Jacob had more than one daughter and more than one granddaughter. It is unusual, though certainly such things are known to happen occasionally, for one sex to be so predominant in a family throughout 2 generations. And it seems to be very probable in this case that God actually did intervene and he actively caused the production of an abnormally large percentage of males so that a more rapid foundation could be made to enlarge the Israeli nation. The females who married outside the family would have to be reckoned as outside of the developing nation. It may also be that other daughters did exist, but had married, and so did not migrate to Egypt. There also seem to be some minor difficulties interpreting these numbers and these lists of names. But if one truly understands all that is said and all that happened, and we may not be able to understand everything that happened, no doubt this is an accurate list and an accurate number. Verse 28, and he sent Judah before him unto Joseph to direct his face unto Goshen, and they came into the land of Goshen. As Jacob and his family came into Egypt, they knew that they would be stopping in Goshen, according to Joseph's instruction in Genesis 45 and 10. So Joseph's headquarters were not located there. They were further south and west. Therefore, Jacob sent Judah, who was now recognized as the leader among Jacob's sons, to go on ahead and tell Joseph to meet him in Goshen and to direct them exactly where to go. Verse 29, and Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to meet Israel his father to Goshen and presented himself unto him, and he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. So as soon as he heard his father was coming, Joseph hitched up his chariot. He went up to Goshen to meet him. When they finally met for the first time in over 22 years, the joy was almost unbearable. No words could or even needed to be spoken at all. Joseph could merely throw his arms around Israel's neck, where he wept a good while. So this was quite a reunion now. This son, who didn't even know if his father was alive a short while before this, hadn't seen him in 22 years. This father, who thought for sure that his son was dead and would never see him again, now they have a meeting. Verse 30, and Israel said unto Joseph, now let me die, since I've seen thy face, because thou art yet alive. So when Israel was finally able to speak, he managed to be able to say only that he was now happy. He was ready to die in this happy state. He was now in a condition of peace. His beloved son was still alive, and he'd seen his face. That was his prime objective now, was to know that Joseph was all right. Verses 31 and 32, and Joseph said unto his brethren and unto his father's house, I will go up and show Pharaoh and say unto him, my brethren in my father's house, which were in the land of Canaan, are come unto me. And the men are shepherds, for their trade hath been to feed cattle, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. So after this emotionally charged greeting that was had between Jacob and his son Joseph, after this was all finished, it was necessary to get down to the practical business of finding a home for the Israelites. Joseph had selected Goshen as the most suitable location, a land which was fertile and essentially unsettled by the Egyptians and adjacent to Canaan. Pharaoh knew they were coming in Genesis 45, 17 through 20, but evidently had not made a formal commitment as to the geographical location. The Egyptian people, according to both the Bible and secular historians, actually despised the profession of shepherding. Up to this point, apparently, Pharaoh had not really been informed of the fact that the Israelites kept flocks and herds. For this reason, it would be better for them to keep more or less segregated from the Egyptians. Verses 33 and 34, and it shall come to pass, when Pharaoh shall call you and shall say, what is your occupation? Then ye shall say, thy servants trade hath been about cattle from our youth even until now, both we and also our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination unto the Egyptians. So Joseph carefully instructed his brothers to stress the fact that they were shepherds, to tell Pharaoh in no uncertain terms that they kept these herds. And the reason for this was so that it would encourage Pharaoh to designate Goshen as their home. Joseph wanted them to have this land of Goshen. It was a nice area. It was just exactly what the Israelites needed at this time. And it would also keep them separate from the Egyptians. Had they just been scattered out in the country of Egypt, they would have no doubt been encouraged to mix with the Egyptians. And this would have brought about things like intermarriage, and eventual assimilation of the Israelites into the Egyptian culture and nation. That was not what was wanted. The desirable thing was for God's people to be separate from the rest of the nation. And so to bring up this fact that they were shepherds, a thing that was despised by the Egyptians. The Egyptians liked to farm the fertile shores of the Nile. And so to bring up the fact that they were shepherds would help to keep this barrier between the Israelites and the rest of the Egyptian people. So regardless of how much the Egyptians despised the occupation of being shepherds, the Israelites were not ashamed of this. They definitely owned up to it and proclaimed it as something they were glad to be doing. And certainly it was a good thing for them. It was the trade they knew the best. They were well suited to it. And it also would be the very thing that would be the best for them as they moved on out of this nation 400 years from now into the wilderness and on into the land of Canaan. They were a nomadic group as they did this. And being the nomads, knowing how to take care of flock and move flock and have the flock to prosper as they moved along the grazing lands would be a very beneficial thing for them. So they maintained their original occupation. And here again, anytime we're doing something that is honest and something that is productive and worthwhile, we should not be ashamed of it. Just do the best job that we know to do, perfect it, and it'll be a blessing for us. It was God's will for them to do this, and they continue to do it. Here we have the children of Israel settled in the land of Goshen. Over 400 years later, these Jews would still be in the land of Goshen. It was an area very appropriate for their purposes. They could remain segregated from the rest of the land of the Egyptians, and they could raise their flocks and provide for themselves. We're also now going to see another 5 years of the famine, and this is the main reason for them coming to Egypt in the first place, so they can survive this other 5 years of famine. But God has other reasons for them coming here. God is now preparing this nation for its true role as inhabiting the land of Canaan as the masters of that land. And that's what he wants them to do, to divide it up among the 12 tribes and to be the masters of that land. He wants them to be the source through which God is served and through which eventually the Messiah will come. And so they're here for a purpose. They don't even know all the reasons yet, I'm sure. But if we look back and see what happened as the whole of history unfolds, we can see that God had a reason for it, and it was a good reason. We close at that point. This concludes the 46th chapter of Genesis. In our next lesson, we plan to begin chapter 47 of Genesis. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying goodbye, friends. we are in Him. So we're told here very plainly that the gauge to go by to determine if we truly love Him, if we're truly accepted by Him, is whether or not we keep His commandments. Well, we have to first of all know what those commandments are